Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. As I wrote last week in an article called I Voted for This, Trump critics on the left and right have predictably erupted in outrage over the United States' targeted extraction of cartel gangster and illegitimate Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Since then, at least until the news cycle was hijacked by the shooting of a female activist who tried to run over an ICE agent, the Trump haters on left and right have been blustering about international law and calling for Trump's impeachment. The reason I call the article I Voted for This is because I voted for a president and an administration that successfully conducts laser-focused law enforcement strikes instead of losing forever wars and then abandoning billions of dollars worth of military equipment and weaponry for our enemies to appropriate. I voted for a president and an administration that takes swift, effective, decisive action to make the Western Hemisphere, our neighborhood, our backyard, safer and free of the insidious encroachment of our enemies. I voted for a president and an administration that is not buying into the failed liberal global order of international law and America-hating transnational institutions like the UN. Let's get real. International law has never been anything but a strategy of our enemies and some jealous allies to rein in American sovereignty and the exercise of American power for American interests. If that sounds illiberal or imperialistic, then to quote J.D. Vance, I don't care, Margaret. I voted for a president and administration that is unashamedly reclaiming our previously unchallenged status as the reigning world superpower. If we're not going to occupy that pole position, who will? Russia? China? Iran? The Arab Middle East? Pretending that our enemies don't each want to be the preeminent world superpower is dangerously naive. They don't feel the necessity to clear everything they do with the European Union or the UN because some countries are simply driven by a lust for power, and they don't care about the rules-based international order overseen by the effeminate leaders of the EU, who, by the way, can't even prevent the collapse of their own countries. If America doesn't step up and assume the role of the world's leading superpower, somebody else will. And it won't be a liberal democracy. Contrary to what the Democrat Party would have you believe, the world is not a better place when America settles for being just another player on the world stage. We live in interesting times, as the ancient Chinese curse goes. From our own hemisphere to the revolution in Iran, epic historic changes are taking place. And to gain some insight into that, I have the perfect guest on the podcast today. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a ridiculously interesting guy, a journalist and a war correspondent, the best-selling author of more than a dozen works of nonfiction, and even a few novels as well. He's even been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work exposing Iran's nuclear weapons program. I have known him for years, and on a personal note, I'll just say that for all that he's been through as a globe-trotting journalist, he's always upbeat and never without a big grin on his face. I'm honored to have him as a friend. This is his second time on the Right Take podcast. Ken Timmerman, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Likewise. Ken, I want to make sure that I mention at the outset that you put out a weekly email newsletter called Threat Watch, which keeps subscribers up to date on foreign affairs. I get the newsletter, and I think everybody who wants to be informed from an insider's perspective about issues ranging from Iran to China to Ukraine and more should sign up for it. Should listeners just go to kentimmerman.com to do that?
Yeah, that's the easiest way to do. There's a pop-up form. And by the way, I don't sell your names. I don't do anything like that. You'll just get this email probably in your junk folder to start with. But yeah, it's a once a week email newsletter.
Great. And great to have you. Where are you calling from right now? Because I know you the last time you were calling from your estate in France.
Yeah, well, now we have moved a number of years ago to the Jacksonville, Florida area from suburban Maryland up near Washington, D.C. And I tell you, we have not looked back one instant to the D.C. area. We don't regret it a minute.
I can imagine. Ken, let's talk first about what just went down last week in Venezuela and what it means for the United States and the Western Hemisphere. By extracting the illegitimate President Maduro, what message did Trump send about American sovereignty and power?
Well, as you have said, as he have said, it's the Monroe Doctrine. He is updating the Monroe Doctrine, telling the world, but also our immediate neighbors, that you are in our backyard, and we want to make very sure that our backyard is safe, it is secure, that bad things are not happening that can infiltrate across our immediate border. We will build a big fence to make better neighbors. That is also, I think, a message that went out on day one of his administration, his second administration. And he's saying to the local leaders, whether it's in Venezuela, whether it's Peru or Colombia, Brazil, he's saying, look, we are the big daddy. We're the big daddy. And we really would like you to behave and be good neighbors and behave well in our backyard. Please don't ship drugs into our country because we will do bad things to you. Please don't welcome terrorists into your country to infiltrate them into the United States because we will also do bad things to you for that.
Yes. And does this Monroe Doctrine, as Trump himself rather hilariously calls it, does it signal the beginning of the end of the rules-based order of global liberalism or liberal globalism, whichever? Because he has Europe, for example, freaking out about America becoming the world's preeminent superpower again.
I think what it signals is the end of globalism, but not the end of our global responsibilities. Hmm. And there's a big difference between the two. Globalism, as you just said, is a global liberal doctrine that essentially means America will be the world's piggy bank, the world's ATM machine. We will consume all the excess goods produced in China, in Thailand, in all kinds of countries in the third world, and you can export them to us and take over our markets. And in exchange, we will give you security. That has been the post-World War II order. We have essentially assured the security of the world's shipping lanes, not just across the Atlantic, but also in the Far East. And in exchange for that, we've allowed everybody else to rip us off. Well, those days are over. And President Trump made that clear in his first term. We had a brief hiatus in what I would call an illegitimate president for 4 years. Mm-hmm. But now President Trump is back and he's saying, no, we're going to make this permanent. The United States is no longer going to get suckered into buying all of your cheap junk and assuring your security. We're going to take care of our security first and we will have free trade, but it will be fair trade. And that's a big difference. So we have global responsibilities, but no longer that global world order that disadvantaged the United States.
Yeah. And for a couple of Democrat presidential terms or tenures through Obama and through Biden, they actively sought to reduce American preeminence on the world stage. But is the world a safer place when America is just another player on the world stage?
No. And we saw that during Biden when Russia invaded Ukraine. Trump has said repeatedly, and I happen to think he's right, that Russia never would have invaded Ukraine in 2022 if Donald Trump had still been president. There would have been other arrangements made. Putin would not have dared to take that step with Trump in power. So, the globalist mantra of leading from behind, that was how Obama put it, is a very dangerous thing to do. And it leads to wars around the world. And it also leads to adventurism. Look at what Obama and Hillary Clinton did in Libya, overturning Gaddafi. Look at the Arab Spring, which was U.S. instigated, run by Soros institutions, foundations, and USAID. We basically destabilized the entire Middle East and brought to the fore Muslim Brotherhood dominated governments, regimes that sowed death and destruction and terrorism, not just in the region, but around the world. So that is over now. That is over. Yeah. We are now in a new era of American dominance.
And for those Trump critics who fret that we're going to get ourselves into an Afghanistan-style nation-building quagmire in Venezuela, do you think that's going to happen? What would you say to those critics?
Well, I think the president is very clear that he doesn't want that to happen. That is not his goal. It's not his objective. And he's going to do everything possible not to go down that road. Look, there are no troops on the ground in Venezuela. We had that amazing military operation. And I think we're just beginning to learn how amazing it was, really. I think we're going to learn more in the coming weeks about what actually happened. But in an amazing military operation, we extracted the guy and his wife and essentially told his successors, you behave or else you are next. And I think that's going to have very far-reaching consequences. We don't know yet, Mark, how that's going to work out. We don't know whether the new Venezuelan government is going to actually listen to the United States. If they don't, as Pete Hegseth likes to say, fool around and find out.
That's right. And what does the Maduro extraction mean for Iran and China? Because Venezuela was the closest ally, I think, in the Western Hemisphere for Iran's mullahs, for example, who are in the process of collapsing. And I'll ask you about Iran in a moment. And the Chinese regime thought that it had a deal locked up with Maduro for Venezuelan oil. So what does that now mean for Iran and China?
A different message for the two of them. For the Chinese, I think what's going to change is the price at which they buy the oil. They were getting a discount of about $20 a barrel. Right?
Yeah.
Venezuela was sending about 90% or 95% of its oil to China at those heavily discounted prices. President Trump has made clear he will not cut off oil exports to China from Venezuela. We are going to take a certain amount of oil first, and it's probably going to go into our strategic petroleum reserve. But after that, we will allow Venezuela to sell oil to China, but it won't be at that discount. So he's not going to cut them off. He's just going to end that privileged relationship. For Iran, it's a very different story. I would not like to be the leader of the Quds Force today in Iran. I would not like to be a senior Revolutionary Guards leader today in Iran. Yeah. There are many of them who are actually under indictment in the United States for terrorism charges and other things. And who knows what could happen to those people. And that's exactly what Trump wants them to think.
Yes. Okay, about Iran, you have so much extensive familiarity and experience with Iranian politics, and in fact, your most recent book is called The Iran House. Tell us a little bit about The Iran House, and also give us your thoughts on the revolution that's taking place there now.
Yeah, The Iran House, you know, I've been doing Iran for, almost 40 years now, Mark.
Yeah.
And The Iran House actually takes its name from a meeting that took place in my house in Kensington, Maryland, between Uri Lubrani, who was Israel's chief Iran expert and policy. He was in charge of Iran policy for many, many years in Israel. He became a very good friend of mine in the late 80s. And Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince of Iran. So this was a secret meeting in the mid-1990s. And we were having dinner essentially over a beautiful Tabriz mahi carpet. And one of the people there said, Ken, this is fantastic. This is the Khane Iran, the Iran house. And this is a historic meeting between Reza Pahlavi and Uri Lubrani, that chief Israeli negotiator. Look, the Iran house is kind of a successor to my earlier memoir, which was my story about how I went from being a left-wing intellectual in Paris to a conservative born-again Christian Zionist, but it is not so much a personal story. It's kind of outtakes from my reporting history. So I take you to the mountains of northern Iraq, looking at Iranian Revolutionary Guards bases, a place where I almost got kidnapped a couple of years ago by IRGC people. It takes you all over the Middle East to the United States. There's even a wonderful endless bowl of caviar in Los Angeles with a Nigerian Lebanese billionaire. A very funny story. And at the end, there are a number of chapters that tell my story of becoming a agent runner for the U.S. intelligence community. I had a network of Iranian sub-agents because I've been debriefing defectors from Iranian intelligence for well over 30 years. Bob Baer, who some of you might know, was a former CIA operative, written a number of books. And Baer has said at one point of me that I had spent more time debriefing Iranian defectors than anybody at the CIA. Now, I hope that's changed by now.
But yes,
that was certainly true 10 years ago. And so I developed a network of sub-agents inside Iran, inside the Supreme Leader's office, working with the Trump administration and the U.S. intelligence community. And I'm able to tell that story because I was not a U.S. government employee. I was not a U.S. Intelligence officer, but I was working as a informant for the USIC, for the U.S. intelligence community. And my network was able to help President Trump make the decision over the New Year's holiday, 2019-2020, to take out Qasem Soleimani. Because my guys knew that he was going to Baghdad to lead this demonstration that was not a demonstration. It was going to be a takeover of the U.S. embassy. And by the way, you also learn in the book, a takeover that was asked for, that was requested by a senior advisor to Joe Biden, then running for president. The Democrats actually asked the Iranians, and I've got the text of some of those communications at the back of the book. They asked the Iranians, would you please do to our embassy in Baghdad what you did to our embassy in Tehran in 1979? They thought that way they could actually discredit President Trump and Biden would win the election in 2020. Well, we know they had a different game plan when that didn't work. They did it a different way.
Yeah.
But they were asking the Iranians to take our embassy. Mark, it is totally treasonous. And nobody, yeah. I am the first one to actually tell that story and to document it at the end of the book in the appendix with some of these communications in Farsi and with English translations.
I have not yet read The Iran House, but I can tell you that, and I can tell the listeners, that the previous memoir that you referred to, And the Rest is History, it's called, it is an awesome read. I highly recommend it. But let's get back to your thoughts on the Iranian revolution taking place now.
Well, it is a revolution. And it's a revolution that began actually in 1999 with the students rising up against the Islamic regime. It's been going in fits and starts ever since. Probably the largest demonstrations against the regime were in 2009, the so-called Green Movement. It was the last hope for those in Iran who believed they could change the regime by changing the politicians leading it, in other words, through some kind of democratic, peaceful transition. The regime showed that wasn't possible. There is no mechanism in Iran today for a peaceful transition of power. There is no reforming this Islamist regime. And Iranians have woken up to that. And I think you now have the overwhelming majority of Iranians who accept that. You cannot reform this regime and hope it will be better. It has to be completely replaced. Now, how long is it going to take and where will the United States be? Those are open questions right now. We've seen the past two nights calls by Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince, the son of the former Shah, who I know very well. And I just told you about this meeting with him at my house with the Israelis in 1995. He has called for these protests and he does have popularity inside Iran. Will he be able to go into Iran and take control? Not today. There has got to be many things that happen first. The leadership, the current leader, has to leave Iran. You have to have a vacuum at the top. And then Reza has to have the proper security to make sure he just doesn't get schwacked when he goes in.
Yeah.
So a lot of things still have to happen. But I think we are now much, much closer to this type of transition, which will be very delicate and very difficult, but we're closer to it than we've ever been in the past 30 years.
Ken, how different, in a good way, would the last 15 years have been if Barack Obama had supported the Iranian people in their green revolution against the mullahs at that time instead of abandoning them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark, and it's something I've thought about a lot. The Iranian regime is the source of all the evil in the Middle East. How could I say that? Well, look at the Abraham Accords. You know, the Abraham Accords are tremendously important, but they did not stop the source of terrorism. Why? Because it wasn't the Emiratis or the Bahrainis or any of these other countries that signed the Abraham Accords that were the source of terrorism and violence in the Middle East. They were just countries who were going along with the anti-Israel mantra of Arab nationalism that's been around, and an old, tired horse that finally collapsed in its sleep, I think. But the Iranians were still around, and they were still fomenting violence against Israel. They were behind the October 7th attacks in 2023 against Israel. They've been against all of the anti-Israel, anti-Jewish attacks around the world. If you had had a democratic regime in Iran, a truly democratic regime in Iran, and not an Islamic republic, all that would have disappeared. It's like a deadly thorn planted in the heart of the Middle East. If you extract that thorn, the body of the Middle East can live again, can get rid of the poison, and can become a thriving region once again.
In your most recent newsletter, Ken, you make some predictions for 2026. Would you mind sharing a couple of those with us today?
Well, one of them is I think this could be the year that the Islamic Republic falls. I think it's closer than ever before. I think they're teetering on the brink. These protests are widespread. They've been really all across the country. And importantly, they've also included people from every ethnic background. One of the problems that you have in Iran in previous rounds of protest is that they have only been based in Tehran. They've only been Iranians of Persian extraction. And what most Americans don't understand is that Iran is at best 50% Persian. 50% Persian. People sometimes say, oh, well, Persia is rising up. No, it's not. The Iranian people are rising up, and the Iranian people are Persians, they're Kurds, they're Azeris, Turkomans, they're Arabs as well in the southern part of the country along the border with Iraq. They're Baluchis. So you have lots of different ethnicities. And these other ethnicities, for the majority, are Sunni Muslims, not Shiite Muslims. In Tehran, which is, you know, obviously a gigantic metropolitan, well over 10 million people, there's one Sunni mosque. And there's well over a million Sunnis who live in Tehran. So the racism of the regime and the religious sectarianism of the regime are quite extreme and have been resented by the Iranian people for a long time. The second big one I would give you, and it's a completely different area, is that I think the doomers and gloomers who say that we're going to be swallowed up by our debt here in the United States, I think they're all completely wrong. And I think we're going to see massive economic growth in this country and a massive prosperity. And I think it's going to trickle down to all levels of society. So those are kind of two big, but you know, there are other predictions that I make as well. But those are two of the biggest ones.
And would you like to make a comment or two about the Ukraine situation, the Ukraine conflict?
Well, so that is also one of my predictions. I think we will finally get closer to a resolution. I'm not going to tell you it's going to happen in 2026 because the Russians are being quite recalcitrant. And we've seen that just in the past couple of days with Putin saying, well, if you Europeans in France and Britain actually deploy troops to support the peace, we're going to consider any buildings you're in as targets that we can attack. So I think, you know, there will be peace, but we're kind of slowly creeping towards that peace. I think also you're going to see an expansion of the Abraham Accords. I think that is something that the Israelis want. It's something that the Saudis want. And I think it's something that most of the countries in the region want, except for the Palestinians. The Palestinians, a good friend of mine, Shoshana Bryan, likes to say, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. They've had so many chances to make peace with Israel. They've had so many chances to become prosperous, to enter the real world as a normal place instead of this violent, encrusted hatred swirl, this swirl of hatred that they are today. I've been to Gaza many, many, many times. I tell some of those stories in the Iran House. And I think one of the biggest problems there, and it's something that President Trump has not taken into account because it is so far beyond his experience as a businessman and as American, I fear that the Palestinians do not have the capitalist gene that yes. President Trump has. And so when he offered them in his first term a fantastic, the deal of the century, you know, tens of billions of dollars of investment in exchange for peace with Israel and peace in general, and they turned them down. We don't want investment. We don't want to get rich. We don't want our children to be happy. We want to die martyrs. We want to die shaheed. We want to murder Jews. We want to exterminate yeah. Jews. And that's something that President Trump just finds so alien and so difficult to understand. A lot of Americans find that difficult to understand as well. I've seen it on the ground. Yeah. It's very, very real. It's tragic in a way, but it's something that you have to deal with in a real fashion. And unfortunately, the only way to deal with it in a real fashion is to for the Israelis to have their foot on the throat of Hamas.
Yeah, that's a big concern of mine about Donald Trump is that I think sometimes he doesn't understand ideology, that he thinks every conflict can be solved just by bringing all the parties to the table and making a quote-unquote deal.
You know, Mark, setting aside what the Democrats and the leftists in this country think about Donald Trump and their Trump derangement syndrome, Trump is the epitome of an American optimist.
Yeah.
He believes in American exceptionalism. He believes that everybody given a chance just wants to get ahead and create the conditions for success, and people will be happy and they'll stop making wars. And you're right, he runs up against reality again and again. He doesn't run from it. Let's be clear. He does not run from yeah. that reality. But he does run up against it, and his optimism gets tempered by the tragic hatreds, the ancient hatreds that you find in Hamas and elsewhere in the Middle East, and that you find in the Slavophiles in Russia, Putin, starting with Putin as well.
So I take it that you don't think that Trump is going to be especially successful in his plan to turn the Gaza into a sort of French Riviera of the Middle East.
I don't think that's going to work, but I do think there will be a peace arrangement that ultimately leads to the disarming of Hamas. The president has mentioned this several times, and he understands clearly that Hamas has not disarmed. And that's a big deal, because in the beginning of this, he was saying, oh yeah, Hamas is going to disarm, but not to worry, in 2 weeks we're going to be in there. We're going to have lots of troops from foreign countries. We've had commitments from over 40 countries to send troops. And then one by one by one, all of those countries except for Turkey, who's on Hamas's side, let's not forget, Turkey is a Muslim Brotherhood, is run by the Muslim Brotherhood and supports the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Hamas. All of those other countries said, nope, we're not going in until Hamas has been disarmed, because we don't want to have to shoot fellow Muslims. Well, I predict that we will succeed in disarming Hamas, probably violently, and that that will happen within the next 12 months. Now, I could be wrong. I may be too optimistic here, but I know that the president certainly wants that to happen, and the Israelis want that to happen.
When do you think Trump is, this is something that frustrates me a little bit, when do you think Trump is going to get around to officially declaring the Muslim Brotherhood and all of its various affiliates a terrorist organization?
That's also a very good question. We know that he had a report delivered to him by Marco Rubio and by Secretary of the Treasury, Scott Bessent, on, I believe it was Christmas Eve. And so far, unless I've missed it, we've not heard what that report recommended. My guess is it recommended that he declare that they are a terrorist organization, because clearly they are. I mean, there's no doubt that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization and an international revolutionary organization. They seek to overthrow our way of life. They seek to take over other governments in Europe and even in the United States. This is their declared goal. They would like to impose Sharia law everywhere, including right here. They would like to impose it on Americans who would not even recognize a mosque if you created one in their backyard.
Let me shift gears a little bit. You have such a wide-ranging understanding of global politics. I'm curious to know what is most concerning to you currently in terms of threats to America. And that could be both domestic and foreign.
You know, I think... I would almost say the domestic threat is the biggest. We have the largest military, the most competent military in the world. We saw it on display in the takedown of Maduro, or the capture of Maduro just recently. We can do anything militarily. But what we can't do is guarantee the worldview of our children. And children who are placed in the government schools across the country are being indoctrinated day in and day out. You know, I wonder, I'm lucky in that my children are out of college, they're out of university, and they escaped the worst, because one went to school in Sweden and was studying banking. The another one was studying engineering. Those are kind of hard, used to be hard to politically correct. I mean, even today, they're doing it with engineering and math. But look, you go to college, you send your kids to college in the United States, and you're essentially sending them to be, you're paying for them to be indoctrinated in a left-wing globalist ideology, which thinks that America is the worst country ever to have been invented on the face of the planet and must be defeated one way or another. And I think it's in part because of that, you see this unholy red-green alliance between the left-wing activists and Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, when in fact these, you know, just the trans people who support Hamas, well, they're gonna, I guarantee you, if Hamas ever took power in a place where they live, they'll be the first ones to be tossed off the 8-story buildings to their deaths. And gay people and others, there's no tolerance in Islamic Sharia law for that type of behavior or that type of ideology. So I almost believe that our greatest danger, the greatest threat to American freedom and American democracy, is right here at home. It is ideological. And the majority of Americans simply don't want to recognize it because it's uncomfortable, and it pits us against our neighbors. It pits us against our neighbors. Yep. And people don't like that. You don't want to be fighting with your neighbors. Nobody wants that. They fight with us. I guarantee you, they fight with us. And anyhow, so I think that that is, we have a problem here at home with ideology, and we are loath to recognize it.
I totally agree with you. A couple of last questions for you, Ken. First, what are you working on now? And second, how can people best keep up with you?
Well, the second one is easy. Just go to kentimmerman.com. Subscribe to my newsletter. It's basically a weekly column. So I you know, there are a few things every week that are going on around the world that I comment on. I do a weekly podcast called Prophecy Today Weekend, which airs on Saturday at 1 o'clock. You can just Google that, Prophecy Today Weekend. And as for what I'm working on, it's what's going on. I mean, you never know week to week what's going to happen. That's why I love being in the news business, Mark. There's always something. There is always something. Look at Donald Trump. What a surprise. I mean, I was working on his national security strategy during the election season at the America First Policy Institute, where I'm a senior fellow. And we had crafted a draft document thinking that this would help, you know, his incoming administration. Well, 1 year later, he puts out his new strategy, the national security strategy, probably half the length of what we had written for him. And I don't think there's a single word or phrase that he used from what we did. And it's all in Donald Trump's own voice. And this guy just surprises you every single day. The shift to the Western Hemisphere was something that none of us, being outside of the circle of power, could have predicted or proposed because it was too big. It had to come from the president himself. So this national security strategy and the pivot away from Asia, you know, everybody was talking about the pivot to Asia during the Biden administration. Well, you know, Trump says, heck with that. We don't need to pivot to Asia. We can deal with China in another way. We don't need to deal with them militarily. We can deal with them economically. And we don't have to go to war with China. It's not inevitable to have a war over Taiwan. But let's pivot here to the Western Hemisphere. This is our backyard. We need to control it. And that's going to be the top priority. Secure our backyard and make sure that we are no longer invaded by drug traffickers, human traffickers, terrorists, and narco villains.
Yes, never a dull moment under Trump, I guess.
Never a dull moment. And thank God for that, because, Mark, he is looking ahead to combat dangers that most Americans don't even see yet.
Ken Timmerman, thanks so much for coming back to The Right Take. Keep up the great work.
My great pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me on. God bless.
Listeners, Ken has so many books I can highly recommend, not only for his insider political insights, but for the sheer entertainment value of his globe-trotting escapades, many of which are nail-biting and jaw-dropping. Just to name a couple of the most recent, which I briefly mentioned before, The Iran House, and his memoir, And the Rest is History, Tales of Hostages, Arms, Dealers, Dirty Tricks, and Spies. Great reads, both. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. As always, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.